From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a deadly mine explosion in Turkey. Latest on the Ukraine crisis. Nigeria wants help finding those kidnapped girls and subduing Boko Haram. Plus, more cases of MERS in the U.S. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. In Turkey, a local mayor says 157 miners are dead and hundreds more trapped after an electrical explosion and fire Tuesday at a coal mine south of Istanbul. Rescuers are pumping fresh air into the mine as they struggle to get the trapped miners out. Speaking at the mine, Turkish Energy Minister Taner Yildiz said, "We're sharing our pain. My uncle died in there. I am in pain." Meantime, President Abdullah Gül has ordered the governor of the region to mobilize all available resources to help rescue the miners. Also in the news, the U.S. State Department released satellite pictures on Tuesday showing Russian forces near the Ukrainian border, despite assurances from Moscow last week that the huge military force had been withdrawn. Earlier Tuesday, pro-Russian separatists ambushed a Ukrainian military armored column near the Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk, killing at least seven soldiers, wounding seven others. Also on Tuesday, International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and others. They talked about the future of Ukraine. Ms. Lagarde reiterated the economic support for Ukraine, but warned that without political stability, the economic program will be hard-pressed.
And we very much hope that every party concerned, including Russia, will participate in supporting this economic stabilization, which goes through that political stability that will be much tested during the next presidential elections due to take place on May the 25th.
Meantime, in Kiev, a spokesman for the foreign ministry said the ministry's main role is to provide opportunities in cooperation with the Central Election Commission for Ukrainians abroad to be able to cast a vote during that election. A Nigerian state governor says all of the girls seen in a video released by Boko Haram are students of the school that was attacked by the militants. Borno State Governor Kashim Shettima says 54 girls in the video have been identified by name, while the rest were identified as girls who were at the government girls' secondary school in the town of Chibok. He spoke Tuesday after organizing a showing of the video for the Chibok community. On Monday, Boko Haram released the 17-minute video that shows about 100 girls dressed in black and gray full-length hijabs sitting in an undisclosed rural area. They are part of a group of about 300 girls who were kidnapped by Boko Haram in mid-April. Meantime, here in Washington, Secretary of State John Kerry spoke about U.S. support for Nigeria in its effort to find the girls.
Our people are on the ground. We are proud to be contributing to the effort in order to help find these young women. And as everybody knows, there was recent evidence demonstrating that at least a certain group of them were together and in one place at a certain period of time. We don't know exactly when. What I can guarantee you is that we will make every effort possible in order to help free those young women. And we are there helping to do that now. I'm not going to discuss what mechanism or methodology may or may not be used in order to do so, except to say that we are committed to this effort, together with, I think, decent and civilized people all around the world who think this is a barbaric, horrendous act against the conscience of people everywhere. The president has all options with respect to the future. We're dealing with the government of another country. That's always got its diplomatic requirements.
And now to Abuja and reporter Heather Murdoch, who is keeping tabs on the Nigerian response to international help.
Some Nigerian officials say the kind of help it has gotten in the past from the international community has not always been helpful. However, Nigerian Minister of Foreign Affairs Aminu Wali says the world's help could be useful right now if it not only extends to the missing girls, but to the larger fight against Boko Haram.
The sudden influx now is more like a fire brigade situation, where there's a particular incident that the whole world wants to see taken care of. Now, okay, we'll take care of that. Maybe the world should may go back again and say business as usual. It is not. I would want to appeal to the international community. It is not.
He says the international community should be working on a long-term plan to contain Boko Haram. Activists say they do not care what the world does next. They want the girls to be found before any other decisions are made. Meanwhile, President Goodluck Jonathan today asked lawmakers to extend the state of emergency in northeast Nigeria. After 4 years of insurgency, emergency rule was declared in three northeastern states on this day in 2013. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
A rights group is saying the ongoing security operation in Kenya is riddled with abuses, resulting in arbitrary detentions, harassment, and forced relocations. Government crackdown began in early April following attacks by unknown gunmen in Mombasa and Nairobi. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Operation Usalama Watch was launched after gunmen killed 12 people in two attacks in March. Much of the security crackdown is centered on Nairobi's Eastleigh and South Sea neighborhoods and the Likoni area of Mombasa. Human Rights Watch researcher Letitia Bader says that's where you'll find thousands of Somalis, ethnic Somali Kenyans, South Sudanese, and Kenyan Muslims.
We're concerned with how the operation is being carried out, both in terms of ongoing abusive, arbitrary arrests. So in terms of the security forces going to people's homes, raiding homes, houses, buildings.
The group is also critical of conditions at places where detainees are being held.
We've been visiting different police stations in Nairobi where detainees have been held in horrifying conditions, overcrowded, lack of sanitary facilities, lack of food and water, but also in terms of the legality of the detentions. Individuals have been held for much longer than what is stipulated under Kenyan law, and it's very unclear why they are being held.
Bader says it's also not clear how many people are being detained.
Well, that's a very good question. The problem is, at the moment, no one and no protection actors actually have access to all the detention facilities where people are being held. So we've heard from the Kenyan authorities numbers up to thousands of people being detained, but key actors haven't been given access to the detention facilities to really clarify and corroborate this information.
She says journalists, Kenyan citizens, and international aid workers have also been harassed. Human Rights Watch also accuses security forces of taking cell phones, money, and other items, including documentation.
The authorities are claiming that what they are trying to do is identify undocumented individuals in this country. But the truth is that in the way the operation is being carried out, they are often overlooking valid documentation. They've been destroying refugee cards, identification cards.
Bader says Kenya has the right to carry out security operations in the wake of attacks. However, she says, authorities have not yet brought individuals to court for the attacks in Mombasa and Nairobi. Human Rights Watch makes a number of recommendations, including giving access to UN officials.
At a minimum, the UN Refugee Organization, UNHCR, is given access to all detention facilities where individuals are being held to make sure that refugees are identified, but also individuals who haven't had the option and the possibility to claim asylum in Kenya, given that registration of asylum seekers has stopped over the last few years. It's absolutely critical that UNHCR has access to all detainees.
The group also calls on Kenyan authorities to make sure its security operation meets human rights standards. Last month, authorities said Operation Usalama Watch had progressed well and was intensified, arresting criminals, suspected terrorists, and illegal aliens. More than 200 people have been scheduled to be deported or sent back to the Dadaab refugee camps in northeast Kenya. At the time, authorities said they were waiting to see official reports of police misconduct. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Prosecutors at the trial of South African runner Oscar Pistorius have called for him to undergo a mental evaluation after a defense witness said he had an anxiety disorder. If granted by the court, the request for a 30-day psychiatric evaluation could delay Pistorius's murder trial. Prosecutor Jerry Nell argued Tuesday that he wants to prevent the 27-year-old from appealing a possible conviction on the grounds of having a mental condition.
We made a point that, and we put it to Professor Foster that, and we will argue, that the accused was not the most impressive witness. We will argue that his evidence be rejected. Isn't that then a reason why a psychiatrist is consulted after his evidence? If that this has been the case of the defense from day one, it's unclear why the expert was only consulted then. That's why, my lady, we argue strongly that the timing of the witness being called and the timing of the consultations is important.
Earlier, a forensic psychologist testified that Pistorius had general anxiety disorder, a chronic condition that causes fear and worry. Defense lawyers could use that testimony to bolster their claim that the runner's shooting of girlfriend Reva Steenkamp last year was accidental.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has announced he has accepted the resignation of UN Arab League envoy on Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi. VOA's Margaret Bashir reporting now from the UN in New York.
Ambassador Brahimi's resignation has been anticipated for some time. The elder statesman has frequently been rumored to be quitting his post and said recently that if elections take place in Syria on June 3rd, that his job to negotiate a political settlement and establish a transitional governing body would be pointless. The UN chief said he regretfully accepted the envoy's resignation effective May 31st after discussing it with Nabil El Arabi, head of the Arab League. No successor has been named.
For nearly 2 years, Joint Special Representative Brahimi has sought an end to the brutal and still worsening civil war in Syria. He has faced almost impossible odds with the Syrian nation, Middle Eastern region, and wider international community that have been hopelessly divided in their approaches to ending the conflict.
When Brahimi was appointed envoy in August 2012, the United Nations said some 20,000 people had died in Syria. In the 2 years, he has worked to find a political solution and overcome the obstacles Mr. Ban mentioned. Activists estimate the death toll has skyrocketed to 150,000 people. Brahimi said he is very sad to leave Syria still mired in crisis, but that he believes it will be resolved.
The question is only, and this, everybody who has a responsibility and an influence in the situation have to remember that the question is how many more dead, how much more destruction there is going to be before Syria becomes again the Syria we have known, the new Syria that will be different from the Syria of the past, but it will be the Syria we have loved and admired for many, many years.
Brahimi, a veteran Algerian diplomat, replaced former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who held the envoy post for 6 months and then quit, blaming the Security Council impasse for blocking his peace efforts. Several names have been floated as possible successors to Brahimi, among them former Tunisian Foreign Minister Kamal Morjane, former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, and UN diplomat Michael Williams. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Jordan's ambassador to Libya was released Tuesday after being detained by his kidnappers for close to a month, Edward Uranian reports.
The small crowd of Jordanian officials and family members clapped
to celebrate the return of kidnapped diplomat Fawaz al-Aitan at Amman's military airport after what he described as a difficult four-week detention in Libya. Al-Aitan spoke with journalists before leaving the airport. He explained that he was being held by the family of a Libyan detained in Jordan. Mohammed al-Darsi, a Libyan national held in Jordan since 2007, was reportedly released late last week as part of the bargain to free Ambassador al-Aitan. Darsi had been held by Jordan over a plot to bomb the country's main airport. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is heading to prison after a long corruption trial that riveted that nation. Robert Berger reporting now from Jerusalem.
A Tel Aviv court fined Ehud Olmert nearly $300,000 and sentenced the former prime minister to 6 years in prison for taking bribes while he served as the mayor of Jerusalem in the 1990s. Mr. Olmert is the first former Israeli leader to be sentenced to time in prison. State prosecutor Liat Ben-Ari told reporters that the message of the court is clear. No one is above the law, she says, and those who commit crimes will be punished. The judge who delivered the punishment said a public servant who accepts bribes is akin to a traitor. He said those who take bribes are a disgrace and they cause the public to lose faith in the government. But Ehud Olmert, who is 68 years old, claims innocence. His lawyer, Eli Zohar, describes the verdict as unjust and vows to appeal to Israel's Supreme Court. He did not take a bribe and he did not receive a bribe, Zohar says. The Olmert case is the latest in a series of convictions of high-ranking Israeli officials on corruption charges. Former Israeli President Moshe Katsav is serving 7 years in prison for rape, and Avraham Herson, a former finance minister, served more than 3 years for embezzlement. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Two health workers at a hospital in the U.S. city of Orlando, Florida, have developed symptoms of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, after having contact with a patient with the virus. The patient who exposed the two workers is also a healthcare worker that's been caring for MERS patients in Saudi Arabia, where the virus was first identified in 2012. He is the second person in the United States to be diagnosed with MERS. An unidentified patient was flying from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to London when he began to feel sick. From there, he took a series of connecting flights to Florida. Dr. Ann Shukat, an official with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says the agency is working closely with its international partners to track down and test some 500 passengers who flew with the unidentified patient, as well to contain the spread of the virus.
For the travel contact tracing, we're working closely with our counterparts in the United Kingdom who will be following up on travelers who were on that first flight that went to London. We're also working with the World Health Organization and with countries in the region. And in fact, we do have a team of CDC staff on the ground in Saudi Arabia working in partnership with the health authorities there and the global community through the WHO. So we're part of an international World Health Organization team in Saudi Arabia, and we're working closely with the British authorities on contact follow-up. It's so important that every country work together in a global community for this kind of new infectious threat. Diseases are an airplane ride away from us, and the more we work together, the quicker we can contain and control their spread.
First case of MERS in the U.S. state of Indiana was announced on May 2nd. No secondary infections have been found stemming from that contact with the first patient. U.S. health officials are encouraging Americans who go to Saudi Arabia to wash their hands frequently and avoid touching their noses and eyes with unwashed hands. As of May 12th, there have been 538 laboratory-confirmed cases of MERS globally. There is no vaccine or known treatment for the virus.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
The outcome of Sunday's Eurovision Song Contest is causing a backlash in Russia and escalating tensions with Europe that were already high over the crisis in Ukraine. The annual song contest is watched by an estimated 180 million people across 45 countries, and this year's winner from Austria has provoked some strong reactions. Henry Ridgewell in London has the story.
Rise Like a Phoenix by singer Conchita Wurst, a performance that won Austria the Eurovision Song Contest crown Sunday after it received more votes than the other 25 finalists. It's the performer's appearance that got the headlines. Conchita is a man dressed as a woman with long hair and a full beard. Wurst called it a victory for European values. It was a victory not just for me, Wurst said, but also for those people who believe in a future that functions without discrimination and which is based on tolerance and respect. Those words were widely seen as a swipe at Russia. Last year, the Russian government introduced laws against what it called homosexual propaganda. In Moscow, there was widespread incredulity at Conchita Wurst's Eurovision victory. Student Alexander Sergeyev called the result unbelievably awful, adding that it shows how much the cult of homosexuality is flourishing in Europe. In my view, he said, this is just a horrifying event, and God forbid that it comes here. Russia came in seventh in the competition, but its performers were booed by large sections of the crowd. The Russian judges awarded all their votes to former Soviet states. In Stockholm, Eurovision partygoers like Ras Andrea praised the judges and the winning act.
They did a great representation of their country, and obviously, as a political stance, making their song and the singer a very key figure in the political climate that we have today in Europe. So definitely, yes, the right song did win.
That political climate has become more hostile. Russia's takeover of Crimea from Ukraine in March has been strongly condemned by Europe and the West, which also blame Moscow for the current unrest in eastern Ukraine. The Kremlin denies involvement. When Russian conductor Valery Gergiev, a high-profile supporter of President Putin's actions in Ukraine, staged a concert in London Sunday, around 30 anti-Putin protesters staged a short demonstration as Gergiev took to the stage. Among them was human rights activist Peter Tatchell.
We felt it was very important to challenge Valery Gergiev over his support for President Putin, his endorsement of Russia's anti-gay law, and his approval of Russia's actions in Ukraine. For him to be able to perform unchallenged would have been very wrong.
Although it appears Russia is facing the beginnings of a cultural backlash in Europe, there was one surprising result. Both Russia and Ukraine voted for each other in the Eurovision Song Contest. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Russia says it will withdraw support for the International Space Station by the end of the decade in response to U.S. sanctions imposed on Moscow for annexing Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula. Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin announced the move Tuesday, saying the Kremlin will also bar the United States from operating GPS satellite navigation system sites in Russian territories beginning in June. Additionally, he said Moscow will bar Washington from using Russian-made rocket engines to launch military satellites. The latest Russian sanctions come as the United States moves forward with plans to deny export licenses for high-tech items that could aid Russia's military. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. Reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. And the latest world news is coming up. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On May 14, 1607, the Jamestown Colony was founded in what is now the U.S. state of Virginia. Jamestown was the first permanent English settlement in the New World. It was named in honor of King James I. In 1787, delegates convened in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in a convention called to write a new constitution for the United States. George Washington presided. On this day in 1796, an English country doctor, Edward Jenner, administered the world's first vaccination as a preventative treatment for smallpox, a disease that had killed millions of people over the centuries. On this day in 1804, explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark left St. Louis, sent by President Thomas Jefferson to explore the newly acquired Louisiana Territory and locate a water route to the Pacific. The so-called Corps of Discovery learned there was no such water route, but it did return information that would spark new interest in the American West. On May 14, 1948, the Nation of Israel was proclaimed, reestablishing a Jewish state after almost 2,000 years. British forces withdrew from Palestine and their administrative mandate for the region came to an end. Immediately, fighting broke out as Arabs moved to put an end to the new nation. On this day in 1955, the Soviet Union and seven of its European satellites signed a treaty establishing the Warsaw Pact, a mutual defense organization that put the Soviets in command of the armed forces of the member states. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A series of illegal referenda took place in eastern Ukraine over the weekend. They were conducted by armed separatist groups and were an attempt to create further division and disorder. These referenda are a clear violation of international law and the territorial integrity of Ukraine. The United States does not recognize the results of these referenda. Moreover, the U.S. is disappointed that the Russian government did nothing to forestall these referenda, since President Vladimir Putin's suggestion on May 7th that they be postponed. Indeed, on the day of the vote, Russian-backed social media and news stations encouraged residents of eastern Ukraine to vote. One even offered instructions for polling stations in Moscow. Russian state media also strongly backed the referenda with no mention of Putin's call for postponement. In addition, President Putin falsely claimed that Russian forces were pulling back from the Ukrainian border. To date, there is no movement of the Russian military away from the border. The focus of the international community is now on supporting the Ukrainian government's efforts to hold a presidential election on May 25th. International observers note that preparations for these elections are proceeding apace and in accordance with international standards, which will allow all Ukrainian people a voice in the future of their country. According to a recent independent poll, a substantial majority of Ukrainians intend to vote on May 25th. Any efforts to disrupt this democratic process will be seen as attempts to deny the rights of Ukraine's citizens to express their political will freely. As President Barack Obama and German Chancellor Angela Merkel stated on May 2nd, the Russian leadership must know that if it continues to destabilize eastern Ukraine and disrupt this month's presidential election, additional sanctions will be imposed on Russia. The United States urges the Russian government to implement its Geneva commitments to de-escalate the situation in Ukraine while there is still time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.